Hello, Esther, and hello everyone, and welcome to Game Changers. I've spoiled who is my wonderful guest for this week or this month, actually. It's Dr. Esther McCallum-Stewart, my colleague, I'm lucky enough to say, but also, God, dynamo in terms of tabletop game, D&D, and just game research in general. So we're super lucky to have you with us, Esther. Hello, and welcome to Game Changers.
Hello, hi. So as Sharon said, my name is Professor Esther McCallum-Stewart. I'm a professor, but also you use the doctor as the thing, so she got my name right, don't worry.
Sorry, I gave doctor, I should have thought
It's a
of that.
weird
I'm
one,
so
isn't it? It's a really
sorry.
funny one. But yeah, so for those of you who don't know me, I'm a professor of games research and game studies, and I actually specialise in kind of non-video game stuff, because I look a lot about how players understand games that they play. So that means that I've kind of gone across all sorts of different things. But I've been playing role-playing games since I was about 17. Played lots and lots of different ones. And obviously that's something that players are really interested in and players do a lot of. And in particular, we've seen this huge rise in D&D, which is 50 years old this year.
Gosh,
This massive...
don't no, because
I
no, because we were chatting about this just before we started recording, and I was giving you my wonderful insight into D&D. I watched the D&D film when I was about 7, and that was where I found out about D&D, and then rediscovered it through Critical Role about blah, blah, years later during lockdown. So there's a big old chunk of history in there that I don't know, and I'm not expecting you to fill in all the gaps, but
No, and I think actually that's how quite a lot of people have their kind of knowledge of role-playing games as well, because you'll play a little bit, possibly at university, possibly just before, and then you sort of go and get on with things and, you know, go on with the real world and getting a job and sorting yourself out. And then you kind of come back to it. And it's also gone in waves as well. There have been times where, yeah, it's been in the media a lot. Because the movie didn't come off the back of the 1980s cartoon, but there was a very, very cheesy cartoon in the 80s. And then there was the movie. You know, and it's a funny thing, because it's not necessarily known as the game. And I think Critical Role is a really good example of that. Lots and lots of people got back into Dungeons and Dragons by watching, or indeed role-playing games, by watching actual plays and watching things on Twitch or on YouTube, with Critical Role being one of the most well-known ones, which is, you know, a bunch of voice actors playing along to a very, very experienced role-playing dungeon master. You know, it's very, very entertaining to watch. And certainly, I mean, I think, Sharon, you said you watched it during lockdown. Yeah, I watched it during lockdown as well.
I don't even know. I can't lie. I don't even know how I found it, because I don't really watch loads of stuff on YouTube. It's I'm not the right, in a way, generation. I feel like I think that was like, that's well after me. But somehow I stumbled across it. I don't know if it was through sort of Will Wheaton's tabletop channel, and then there was a link. I don't know how I did it, but stumbled onto it, and actually stumbled onto season 2, which was when they were so very polished and in the studio, and it was really kind of well kind of presented, production value, which for me is
absolutely.
like a big deal.
Yeah,
and
the
it was
sound and
just
you know
yeah it was just so engaging. It was
yeah
so
yeah
interesting, but
and
also made me want to play again.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny, because I've talked to quite a lot of people about it and I've written about it. And everybody sort of tends to sort of say the same thing. Yeah, it may, not quite sure how they found it, just sort of stumbled across it. I'm guessing it just gathered enough momentum that people started getting really into it. Lots of people watching it during lockdown. Lots of people finding it really soothing. Like, I mean, I have watched both of the first two series twice, and I'm most of the way through the third series, which is kind of, I think they had an anniversary recently of, I think it was 100 episodes, but I can't remember. That sounds like not enough, actually, because I'm quite a long way behind.
It sort of doesn't but sound like enough somehow.
It
Like
doesn't.
season 2 seemed to go on for,
well, season
gosh,
so
ever.
season yeah season 1 and 2, I did some maths on this, because these are the sorts of weird things you have to do when you study this kind of thing. And I did a bit of maths on how many hours on average season 1 and 2 were. And it turns out that season one and two together, there are more hours to watch than there are hours of Doctor Who. Now, Doctor Who's just had its 60th birthday and it's on to its nth Doctor. And,
gosh.
you know, and obviously that's a, you know, that's a program with production values that, you know, they're recording and is a very different type of thing. But when you sort of think about these incredibly long running series and then, but then an episode of Critical Role is often 3 or 4 hours long.
Yeah, and I think
So,
that's why I loved it, because it that comforting thing, like you were talking about, that they are friends, or very genuinely appear to be. I can't, I but they come across as they know each other really well, and it just unwinds, and it's genuinely delightful because they're surprised and you're surprised.
And I've remembered
And
what the anniversary is. It isn't 100 episodes.
oh,
It's 10 years
cool.
of Critical Role.
Oh my, 10
That's
years,
what,
seriously. Holy smokes.
because it actually started very quickly after the release of 5th edition D&D, because they
Okay.
switched from a previous game that they were playing called Pathfinder and
Okay.
then switched over to D&D. And so in the first series, in the early episodes, they actually get mixed up a little bit between their Pathfinder rules and characters
Okay.
and their D&D ones. And in fact, one of the characters, Percy, was the class had to be created by Matt Mercer because there wasn't a gunslinging character, but there was one in Pathfinder, so he had to port it over. And yeah, so all of that ballistics use is pretty much made up by Matt. You can actually go and download the original versions of the character build that he did, as far as you can go and find them. I think one of the things that I really love about D&D is that because it's so player generated, you know, you can go away and find anything. I mean, I'm very into, I've got a lot of expansions and I've got a lot of supplements. Supplements are slightly different from expansions. D&D's just full of, it's full of nerd terms. The expansions are official or officially written by Dungeons and Dragons, and then supplements. And these are the words that I tend to use for them. There's a bit of information. But then supplements tend to be written by fans, and they're published under the various different licenses that D&D allow
Got
publication.
you.
But I'm
Got you.
really, really obsessed with ones both about the sea and about space. And if I could
Okay.
get space and the sea together, so I don't know, you're flying off into the astral plane and it's like a sea, then I'm happy. But I've got about five or six of these different supplements. I've got, you know, Sunken Isles and some of the Eldermancy stuff. And there's always these different character classes. There's always the sort of, I know you can play as a sea wizard, and now you can, you know, here's an extra type of subclass for this and that. And I love the fact that players are just constantly building new things. And sometimes they work and sometimes they don't, and sometimes they're too powerful and sometimes they're not. And you know, I just think it's so creative and so fun as a result of that. But yeah, it's very very good to see. And there are lots and lots of pirates, and I think pirates are interesting because they're very problematic in real life and in history. But they're very romanticized as well. So you've got these kind of swashbuckling people, and then every now and then you'll have sections that there was a real issue with one of the expansions that came out recently, actually. That has some very, very problematic content in it that had to be removed, in fact, where people were like, actually, you know, the history of piracy is it's not great. We, you know, we perhaps might need to have thought a bit more carefully about what we were saying when we did it.
Kind of interesting that actually, yeah, people will, and we'll talk a bit more about kind of, the opportunities for representation and kind of considering where some of these things come from as well. But it is interesting that people have sort of gone, oh, hold on, oh, maybe that's not quite what we want to be saying. And yeah,
Yeah,
now
absolutely. And you know, 50 years is a really long time.
And it actually is for something to, because we talk about kind of, sort of game as a thing kind of being really new. And then if we think about D&D, well, that's got, there's a lot of kind of not crossover, but kind of elements of mechanics and kind of the way that we look at game that's been around for 50 years. And we maybe don't always think about it because it is this thing that is a to be very kind of like putting things in boxes. It's a tabletop game. It sometimes doesn't feel totally a part of video game. I know we have RPGs in video game and those optionalities, but I think when you're kind of coming into it from the outside, we divide these things maybe a little more than we should. But if I can take us one step back, Esther, because we just jumped straight in.
We did, didn't we?
And that's good. I love that because that's amazing. But it might be really cool if it's okay with you. And this podcast is kind of for everyone. So it's for people who are just coming into game. It's for people who are like really heavy kind of gamers and really immersed. But can we just do a brief, like, what is D&D? If you had to just sort of very basically kind of give us a 101, a D&D 101.
So D&D or Dungeons and Dragons is it's considered the original tabletop role-playing game, although it isn't, but it was the one that kind of put the game or the genre on the map, so to speak, and it was the one that is tends to be the one that everybody knows. So it is a fantasy role-playing game in which a group of people gather together socially and play collaboratively. So you are playing against the game rather than each other. And there are a number of different ways that it's played, but it's usually played as a creative exercise. So when I say role-playing, I mean that you're taking on the role of a character and you are embodying them in some way. Now, that might just be rolling dice and ticking numbers on a piece of paper, but that might be kind of full-on immersion where you are speaking as if you are that character and you're only answering kind of in character unless you're asked to do something. And the kind of check to that, the check and the balance, is that you have dice and there are a number of rules. When I say a number of rules, I'll go into how many or how few rules there are in a bit. But when you want to do something or when you're challenged to do something, the person who is running the game, who is usually called the dungeon master, will ask you to roll a dice, and the dice are all different shapes and sizes. I'm not going to be distracted by your cat, Sharon. Definitely not.
He's the most handsome boy in the whole wide world. But there we go.
The ginger cat is also. Anyway, okay. So there's dice, and you basically use the dice to determine whether or not you succeed or fail at something. So it's not just a case of saying I run into the room with my sword and I slay the mighty dragon. You have to roll dice and you have to decide amongst you as a group how you are going to navigate what's called an encounter, which is when you're encountering another creature or whatever you're doing. So some of it is very some of it's very combat orientated, you know, there's lots of going out and fighting monsters, but a lot of it is also very social. So there will be lots of, if again, this is how you like to play it, there will be lots of people talking to each other. You'll be interacting with people that the dungeon master will embody for you, who are called non-player characters or NPCs. And you'll have conversations and you'll sort of have social adventures with people as well. So yeah, that's Dungeons and Dragons. And it's evolved from what was very much a pen and paper game. So it was very much a rolling dice, walking through a dungeon which was mapped out on paper and seeing on whether or not you fell into traps and fighting monsters and not having very many types of character that you could play, to this incredibly complicated three basic volumes of the game that help you play it, that it is now, and that's kind of taken 50 years to get there. But yeah, it's a game that's different for everybody. And I think the thing that, again, there are lots of people that have lots of different thoughts on what Dungeons and Dragons is. And there will be people who are listening to this who are absolutely 100% writing letters to the editor right now saying that is nothing like the game that I play. That's actually what makes role-playing games, tabletop role-playing games, so special, I think, is that it's your game to play with your group the way that you want it to. And it can be pretty much anything. And to give an example of that, I said that I started playing role-playing games when I was about 17, which was obviously about 10 years ago. It's quite a lot.
I mean, exactly the same as
3 years
me.
Ago, yeah. No, absolutely. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But when I first started playing role-playing games, I started by playing three different games, none of which were Dungeons and Dragons, but one of which was called Call of Cthulhu, which is a horror game. And it's a sort of suspense game set in the one that I was playing was set in the 1920s. So you're kind of playing detectives that are fighting these kind of arcane horrors and discovering weird cultists and strange goings on. And the person who ran the game didn't want us to use any dice whatsoever. So it was entirely what's called theatre of the mind. We were entirely playing, using our imaginations and negotiating what was going to happen. Because it's actually quite a difficult game. It's very easy to die in Call of Cthulhu. And he wanted our investigators to survive. They go mad very, very quickly because they see awful things and then they go crazy.
Is it kind of a Lovecraftian?
It is based on
Okay,
Lovecraft's mythos.
cool.
So yes.
There's
But
lots of
he used
madness
to do
there.
lots of madness there, yeah. But he used to do the most amazing things. And one of the things that he would get us to do was we would sit in his bedroom playing, and there was usually about five of us, all sort of squished up on his bed. And when he was doing really scary encounters, he would actually get us to wear blindfolds so that when he was narrating what was going on, we would be super scared. And it was very successful, actually. And he used to use a lot of different music. He used to use Holst's The Planets, which was rather lovely because an event I was at recently, they asked me what music I wanted. And I said, I want Saturn from Holst. And that was why. But I've also played versions where, again, all you do is you roll dice to fight things. It's so different. And neither of those versions are wrong. They're just a different way of doing it, and yeah.
So is one of the things that you like about D&D that it is so kind of fan player oriented. It's so kind of adaptable, and you can make it what you need it to be, especially for the group that you're playing with or working with, especially as a DM.
Yeah, I think so. And I think one of the things that I really love about it is that you can cater it for different styles of playing, for different types of people, for different levels of experience, and for different ages. So technically, you can play D&D from about six up. You probably don't want to play it with children that are much younger than that because concentration is a thing.
And all the dice you have to roll, so many dice.
Yeah, and you don't want to be engaging it at that level, but you can also play it with, as I say, people who are very, very into the kind of side, the mathsy side of it, and don't really want to communicate very much at all. It's run a lot at conventions because you can run very short, what are called scenarios, so you can run a sort of 2.5 an hour thing. And you just meet these people and you sit down and you play a game and then you go away and somebody will be running it for you, so they'll have the experience to tell you what to be doing. But also people play it for years and years. The adventuring party that I was first a member of, as I say, we played three or four different types of games. And we played for years and years. And I don't live in the same area anymore, but I'm assuming that they still play, and that's
Still going. So I
yeah.
think something you mentioned to me, and you don't have to go into details about the character, but I think it was at Worldcon, I think, so forgive me if I'm wrong, but you said that you'd had a chance to play some D&D and you got to play your character that you've been playing for umpteen
Okay, yeah. So
years,
this is a
let's
massive
say.
flex if you know Dungeons and Dragons and you've made it this far.
But you know,
So I
I'm
ran,
just interested.
yeah. So I
And
ran an
flex. Go
event
on,
over
flex.
the I ran an event over the summer called Worldcon, which is a science fiction convention, and it's an international convention. It moves around the world. It's different groups of organisers every year, and one of the things that Worldcon can do is we present a series of awards. They're basically the science fiction Oscars called the Hugo Awards. And alongside that, we are allowed to present a special award. And the special award is not a Hugo, but it can, and it's non-determinate. So it's not necessarily a person, it's not necessarily a movie, it's not necessarily, it can be a thing, it can kind of, it can be a person, it could be an organization. And we decided that the thing that we wanted to give our special award to was Dungeons and Dragons, because Dungeons and Dragons has its 50th anniversary this year. So we thought that would be a great thing to do. So we sent the emails off to D&D, Fortunately, we had some contacts and sort of said we'd like to do this, and we, don't tell anyone. Don't tell anyone we're doing this award.
Oh, shit.
But we'd like somebody, if possible, we'd like somebody to come and accept it.
Yes.
And they wrote back to us and they said, fantastic, yeah, we'd like to send somebody. And we were like, great, they're going to send, I don't know, the marketing manager for the UK. And they sent Chris Perkins. So for those of you who don't know, Chris Perkins is currently the senior story editor. He's actually stepping down this year. He's been involved. He was one of the people who was instrumental in the actual play movement. So he actually started doing actual plays, Acquisitions Inc., years and years before Critical Role. And he's this kind of massive, kind of great big name. Anyway, so they sent Chris Perkins, and bless him, he'd just come back from Gen Con. So he arrived on site, walked into the rehearsal, and then presumably went to sleep for 26 hours. But when he was on stage accepting the award, I'd said to him, I'm going to ask you a couple of questions. And I'd gone through what the questions were, and I said, do you need to rehearse what they're going to be? And he said, oh, no, it's going to be fine. And we'd had a bit of a chat by that point, and I thought, well, it's going to be fine. But I wasn't prepared, because one of the questions he asked, the last question I said, was, how would you encourage other people to get into playing Dungeons and Dragons? Because obviously I'm giving him the award, but he's got to give his spiel. And he said, well, I'm going to show everybody how easy it is to play D&D. And then he turned to me and he said, you walk into a tavern, which is a very classic way of beginning.
It's the
It's
one, isn't it?
the famous way of beginning a game. And my eyes widened, and he said, you walk into a tavern, and there's a halfling in the corner, and there's some people drinking ale, there's some dwarves drinking ale, and da, 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 what do you do? And obviously, I had no idea this was going to happen. But I have a character that I've played for years and years, and I've played her in loads of different ways. I've played her in a LARP game, live action role-playing game. I've played her as a role-play character. I've played her in lots of MMORPGs. You get very fond of your characters, and you take them along with you a little bit. And anyway, so I had 3 minutes on stage role playing as Nevaeh, my character, with Chris Perkins, which was.
See, so glad I remembered this and asked.
Yeah.
Holy snow.
But it was amazing. And it was just. It's funny, actually, because the question before I'd asked, why is Dungeons and Dragons so important? And it was interesting, because obviously that was a huge moment for me, but actually the moment for him was the answer that he gave to the other question, because I sort of asked him a sort of jokey version of, because he's been on Critical Role, I asked him about that. But then he said, actually, the real reason that Dungeons and Dragons is really important is that he had letters from people who'd had life-changing experiences as a result of Dungeons and Dragons, including their decision to remain alive. And he said that was it's happened more than once that people have messaged him and said that they've been in that situation, and Dungeons and Dragons has changed their life that significantly, and that much, one would hope, for the better. And it was, we were on the stage, and I looked at him, and he's a tall guy, and I am quite short.
Looked up at him like I spend my life doing, yes.
But I looked up at him, and his eyes were wet, and I thought, I've got
Course.
to keep eye contact with him, because both of us are going to cry on stage if we. And he was really genuinely, not just passionate about it, but incredibly moved by it. And again, giving him the opportunity to be able to actually answer that question in that way was really, yeah. I think it set the tone for the Worldcon, because that was the first hour.
Oh, yeah, just went uphill from there, you know.
Yes, yeah. But no, so it was so, but yes, it's a very powerful game, I think.
Well, can we dig into that just a little bit? Because you've brought up the kind of that kind of in a way, overview from Chris, sort of that idea of it's so incredibly important to people and on many different levels. So from that very profound and very serious sort of, yes, it's a place for that person at a really difficult time in their life, and it gives them a sense of purpose and meaning in a very, very dark period. I think that, you know, that idea of that other person that you're sort of carrying with you, you know, your character, and also maybe the community that comes along with D&D can be incredibly important for people who are maybe not so outgoing in the real world, or just are struggling. And that doesn't mean that they're not outgoing in the real world, but it gives them a different outlet and a different place. So something that kind of I didn't really think about, but it came out in, again, Critical Role, back to Critical Role, just because it was that sort of revisiting for me and bringing me back to that kind of idea in that community, was the way in which the players played with gender, with sort of presentation, for want of a better word, if that makes sense. And also kind of, you know, just played with a lot of things that maybe we know people need to question, experiment with, explore, but aren't always able to. So I'm really interested in the ways in which representation kind of play a role in D&D, and I just wondered if you could speak to that a little bit.
Yeah, I think so. This is sort of one of the big things that people talk about a lot, in particular at the moment, when they talk about role-playing games, and about how when you play a role-playing game, you can to take yourself out of yourself, which means that you can kind of perhaps find out more about yourself. And I think, again, the important thing to say here is that you don't necessarily also have to do that. You can just play fighter with a big stick.
Yeah.
But having said that, most people who role play find out something about themselves. Now, that might be that they're not very good at, I don't know, thinking themselves out of difficult situations, right? And they need to allow other people to do that. But it's also a really good place to experiment. And I'm going to use a bit of game theory here, and people are going to groan because I'm going to invoke Johannes Hetzinger.
I'm not going to groan because I don't know who that is.
The Magic Circle.
Probably would not be Jester.
So this is a real Games 101, and it's quite argued amongst game scholars, but I think it's a really good way of describing what happens in Dungeons & Dragons. So Hetzinger has this idea called the Magic Circle, and it's a circle. And when you are inside the circle, the rules are different, right? So when you are inside the circle is a space that you can sort of do what you want because you're inside the circle, so it's okay. So a really classic example of this is actually from video games. In video games, it is fine to kill somebody and then go through their pockets and pull out a massive turkey and eat it. Right, it's got no cling film on it. It's not in a sandwich. It's a whole turkey, and you just, I don't know, or you put it in your bags and you carry it around for, I don't know, 12 hours, and then you get it out and you eat it, and you eat 6 carrots with it. Right. Also, there are no consequences for the fact that you've just murdered somebody. In fact, you're encouraged to do that because they've probably got some gold on them as well. Right. They're probably because that's the only currency in video games. Of course, it's not. So inside the Magic Circle, we understand that the rules are different. And we also understand that it's a place that we can do things that we might not be able to in the real world. Role-playing games are very similar. You're being put into situations where you would never encounter those in real life. I really do hope that I don't go outside and 12 rats attack me. You know, that would be bad. I mean, I live opposite
a railway
line. If you
go to New York, I'm giving you very little chance.
I live opposite a railway line. I've seen some fairly gnarly rats out there. I wouldn't want them all running at me at once, you know. And also, I don't carry a sword because I'd be arrested.
True.
And the complication of killing a rat with a sword, again, as the more you think about it, the more illogical it becomes, right? But this also means that once you're inside the Magic Circle, because you understand things are different, you can do things that are different. You understand that it's make-believe. We're not fools. You know, we do understand that a game is a game. And that also means that when you create whatever character you're going to play, often people take the opportunity to playthings that are different, or playthings that they want to maybe even subconsciously just kind of think about. I've got a PhD student at the moment. Hi, Ben.
Was going to come up anyway, but yeah.
He's looking at horror in games. And one of the things that he's noticed is that the first time the players play, they'll play quite sort of simple. They'll play quite basic characters. They're probably going to play soldiers. They're quite into winning, right? They're quite into overcoming. It's an alien game that he's running. They want to try and kill the alien, and they want to try and escape. And then the more experienced players will actually choose things that make that quite difficult. So they'll decide that they want to be the android, because that means that if people find them out, they're going to be in trouble with the rest of the group. And some of them want to play people who aren't soldiers. They want to play people who aren't very good with weapons. And so again, people aren't necessarily deciding that they're suddenly going to flip gender, or, play somebody from a different culture, or whatever it is that they want to think about. But they are thinking about playing things in a sort of different way. And I think if we build from there, you can see why people find it a really interesting space to be able to do things that are perhaps things that they might be, as I say, consciously or subconsciously thinking about. And it's also a space that, again, you sort of mentioned, Sharon. The good thing about games is that when you are playing a game, you are concentrating on playing a game, which means that you're not concentrating on all of the awkward social things you have to do at the same time. Because you know that you've all got together to play a game, and that the ultimate aim of the game is to have fun, right? Now, that might be something that makes you quite anxious, but at the end of the day, you can look at your dice and you can look at your character sheet and you can just play the game. And so the socialization that is often really hard for people, you've got a focus for it. And that happens with board games, that happens with video games, that happens with tabletop role-playing games. Similarly, it also means that if there is perhaps you want to play a different gender, or you want to play somebody with a different sexuality, or indeed your own sexuality that you aren't as comfortable with as perhaps you might want to be, that role-playing games can be a space for that. And games in general, and I think, Sharon, you'll agree from our students, and students, like, if you're listening, don't take this as in any way a knock, because actually I think it's a strength of the games community. The video games community and our students are actually quite neurodiverse. Like, we have a lot of neurodiversity in our cohort. And actually, that's a really good thing. And it's incredibly useful towards games design as well, actually, because there are some facets of neurodiversity that lend themselves incredibly well to making games. But similarly, again, people use or can use role-playing games very much to help themselves navigate things. Role-playing games are often taught to children, and the reason, again, going back to the kind of magic circle idea, they're used with children. They're used with children to, again, help them understand social cues, to help them understand when they should do things and when they shouldn't do things. And just because you get to sort of run around and, as I say, fight rats or dragons or whatever, or one of the things it's very good at doing is again, is teaching you how to relate to other people. Because if you're the one that is constantly trying to be the hero at the exclusion of everybody else, everyone else is going to get bored and they're not going to want to play with you. It's that simple. So yeah, kind of as a result, role-playing games have very much become this sort of space that people do really, really flock to. And the game itself has tried to accommodate that. And I think there's a difference here, because as a gaming community, gaming has changed from, haha, lol, we're all weird nerds and we're all different, to, oh my goodness, everyone plays video games. Everybody plays games. If you get on the train and walk up and down the carriage, there'll be five people playing, there'll be five people watching telly, and there'll be three people playing something on their phones, and there'll be one person reading a book. Probably me.
I was going to say, it's probably me reading the book. I'm very boring.
But I was actually on a train yesterday. I walked up and down, and literally there were two people. There were two people reading a book. I was knitting. But games are just so embedded in our culture now that that whole idea of we're the weird nerds in the corner doesn't really hold water anymore. And it's also, nerds need to get on with each other as well. You know, if we're all weird, then we need to find ways of being weird together. And again, I think games do that very, very well. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's just really, it's because I suppose it takes us to something like Baldur's Gate, just as a sort of a completion of that concept of just playing with what you might want to be, what you could be, or just going, do you know what? I'm going to be the villain. And yeah, I'm going to go against everything that society has told me is right. And I'm going to play the villain path. I never find many people who've played the villain path in Baldur's Gate. I don't know why.
I think you want to talk to the students about that.
I need to talk to the students about that. Maybe that's another conversation that I raise your hand if you've played the villain journey.
Just context there. So last year, Baldur's Gate 3 was released on various different platforms, mainly I think it was Xbox, and because I don't have an Xbox, Xbox and the PC were the main ones. It's on the Mac now, thankfully. It was a huge hit, won loads of awards, won a Hugo, name drop.
Hey.
won the first official gaming Hugo ever. I gave it out as well.
I was gonna say, just to go back to Worldcon, gaming started to become very front and center at Worldcon under your chair.
Yes. It was almost as if I had a chair. I was very into games. But there were lots and lots. We had gaming guests, and Larian, who were the development company for Baldur's Gate, were there. And obviously Chris Perkins was there. And we had three Black Halflings podcasters, and Tanya DeBast, who is also a Twitch streamer, formerly ran I Need Diverse Games. She's just rolled that up, but that was right. Is has written Into the Motherland, which is a TTPRG, which involves a sort of spacefaring races, emphasizing people of color. Really fantastic GM. She's brilliant. Anyway, we had all these people, but so Baldur's Gate was released as a video game. There were two previously, which were very, very rulesy. They're very much about kind of rules based versions of Dungeons and Dragons, and they're both good games.
Mm-hmm.
They did have stories in them, but not perhaps quite as much as this one. And Baldur's Gate 3 is very, very story based. There is lots and lots and lots of interactive role playing. There are, I've got to get it right, 7 companion NPCs, I think, and then there's some extra ones. It's either 7 or 6, I can't remember. Who are all, they've all got these incredibly developed backstories, and you kind of recruit them and you keep them in your camp, and you can have them hanging around with you in a party. But it's really, really, really kind of brings out the both sort of sides of Dungeons and Dragons. Massive hit. But what Sharon was referring to is that there is at least one specific path called the Dark Urge, where you can play as a bad guy, and you're a real bad guy as well. You do absolutely terrible things. You kill my favourite tiefling, who's the bard tiefling who sings the amazing song. Sorry, that was a spoiler. That was a spoiler if you've not got to that bit. It's really horrible. And it's interesting from a sort of back of the envelope research.
Mm-hmm.
Most players go through a phase where they'll play the bad guy, and then they'll kind of come out the other side and play more grey characters. Yeah. Usually, it's actually, even if you've got a story arc like Dark Urge, it's actually very, very difficult to play bad guy characters if you're playing with other people. You can kind of do that thing where you're all playing bad guys, so you're all playing villain, and you've all decided that you're going to just go and cause trouble.
Yeah.
But quite often, if you're playing with a group, it's very hard. When I was young, I played bad guy, and she was Lizette, her name was, and the only way that I was able to do it was with extensive conversations with the DM the dungeon master
Mm.
before and after the game, because he wouldn't tell me what was going to happen, but there was an element of having to try and get away with it all the time, because you can't be doing things in front of, you can't be role-playing really evil stuff in front of the rest of the characters where they're kind of good guys, because
Yeah.
they'll just catch you and throw you out.
Mm.
Because they're trying to be good guys. So it's actually quite hard. And I think, I mean, I'm quite kind of positive about this sort of thing as well. I actually think that it is also difficult because fundamentally we all want to be good people and we want to be liked.
I think that's what morality is, isn't it? And that's why you were saying it's actually, I know what you're saying about the construction of the game from the DM side of things, and you can't kind of be twirling your mustache of evil, and all of your colleagues playing have to sort of switch off for a minute while
And
you're
I
kind of
think that's
doing that.
important. That's important as well, because there's an element of the, I mean, this goes back to sort of learning how to play with other people.
Of course, yeah.
That if you're not playing in a way that other people like, they won't play with you again. If you're a dick, people aren't going to want to play with you. And they'll tell stories about what an asshole you've been when you played the game. And they'll tell
Yeah.
stories about how they didn't enjoy themselves because you were trying so hard to be, whatever it was that you were trying to do. And actually, again, that's quite a sort of common refrain.
Yeah.
I think the thing is, yeah, if you're all trying to do the same thing together, it works, but it
Yeah.
doesn't if you're really, really antagonistic to other people. And they'll just, they'll vote with their feet.
It's sort of for me, having experienced something like that. It's also sort of if you're playing as a team and you're all kind of like after the same goal, there's sort of then pleasure, at least this is from my point of view, not from anyone else's. I'll speak for myself, not for everyone. But there's pleasure when your party splits up, say, and you can see your peers playing out, and you're not playing because you're sort of sitting there waiting for your turn in the other side of the forest or whatever it might be. There's pleasure in watching your peers explore and kind of roll the dice and kind of do their thing,
Absolutely.
which when sort of maybe someone takes over a game or isn't really playing with a team spirit, let's say that, you kind of get a bit bored because it's just that person doing everything, and you're like, oh, I came here to do some stuff.
I came here to, I came, yeah. And I think that's another
Trying
thing,
really
like,
hard. This
again,
is really hard for
yeah.
me.
It, one of the things that I think Critical Role is really, really good at is literally taking turns.
Yes,
And
yeah.
it there's a couple of reasons why they're so good at it. Firstly, because Matt Mercer, who's the GM, very effectively moves between the group. But the second is actually because they're voice actors.
Of
So
course,
they're
yeah.
voice actors, which means they're very skilled in not interrupting each other. Even if they sometimes do, they will dial it back and stop
Space
talking over
there,
each
isn't
other.
there, to explore, yeah.
And they've got the trust to let each other take turns. And there's a really good example of this from Critical Role, actually, is that they a few years back, they basically needed to expand because they were all getting absolutely exhausted. And they brought in a new GM called Abria Iyengar, who's absolutely wonderful. And they had what they usually do with the sort of spin-off games is they have two or three of the established cast, as they're known, and then they get new people in. And they brought a new group in, and one of the people in this group just didn't really get it. They didn't really get that you need to not be the special person all the time,
Yeah.
and that you need to kind of take turns, and that also when it's your turn, you don't do everything. So you don't say, and then I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do this. Now, D&D theoretically lets you do things, lets you do about three things. You do a pre-action, an action, and
Yeah.
I'm
Yeah.
paraphrasing the rules very, very specifically there.
Yeah, there's a sort of a box around your turn sort of
Your
thing,
turn,
and
yes. And then
yeah.
you move on to another person's turn. And what usually happens in Critical Role is that actually the narration moves to the next person as well. Because
Yeah.
these, the previous cast or the established cast, they really understand that. And they do that. Unfortunately, this person didn't really understand that and wasn't picking up on the cues that Abria was giving them as well. Like, and again, watched this back a few times. There are a couple of times where the GM actually says to them, "You need to stop, right? You need to stop and let other people have a go." And they just are so excited and they're enjoying themselves so much that they don't really realize what's happening. Huge internet, you know, this person is terrible. What a, you know, how dreadful, dreadful, dreadful. I actually just think it was just overenthusiasm and wanting to be really good as well, you know, wanting to succeed and wanting to win. But again, a really good example of just not quite reading the room. And it is unfortunate because, as I say, Abria does actually say to this person, "You need to just back off and let other people have a go." It's very difficult to do when you're doing a live recording. You can't say, "Shut up, sit down," you
I
know.
mean, yeah. I suppose there's a lot that I mean, people do that when they're not being filmed and you know, like in a just a group play. But I like you say, quite a lot of pressure on that person. This is a big deal. This is critical role adjacent, you know. So there's that element too.
And some of the actual plays are cut and edited, but Critical Role isn't. It is
Yeah.
it the whole thing is
It
broadcast.
plays out, doesn't it? Yeah.
So you can't be, and if again, in season one, there is a person who is in the first few episodes who the rest of the cast get increasingly upset with and is doing things that are just not very, they're just, in the words of the Princess Bride, they're not very sportsmanlike. And that person is not in the series anymore, and you know, quite infamously so. But there's a very there's one particular scene where, again, I say scene because they're very good at acting. One where they set up something that they want to do, and one of the characters needs to roll a dice to hit something with their bow and arrow. And again, Critical Role people don't at me if I'm not quite right on this, but this is my memory of it. So the character's called Vex'ahlia, and she is firing at something in the ceiling to try and hit it, and it's a sort of one in a million shot. And if it works, you know, the reward will be great. And given all of her bonuses and all her extras and all the other spells everybody else is casting, and everybody's kind of expending energy and their stuff to make her better, she manages to roll a very high roll, which I think is a 30. You can only get if you've got all of these other people helping you out. And so she hits this thing, and you know, Matt Mercer says, you know, brilliant, it falls from the ceiling and it starts crashing down. And the guy who's no longer in it says, "Oh, well, I would have done that with so and so with such and such and such a spell anyway." And it's just such a Sharon's face is just like, oh, it's just
Oh,
such,
it just annoys me.
you didn't need to do that. You don't need to take that person's thunder and their moment away from them, because the rest of the cast are like, "Oh my goodness, this is amazing," you know. And he's just like, "Oh well, I could have done that with I can't remember what it is." Very, very sort of, you know, and he again, very, very sort of obvious, jarring. But again, you know, I think these are all quite good examples of the ways that role playing can work to help people understand that they're not perhaps doing things, you know, that they need to kind of be a bit more social, basically. And these two are quite extreme examples, because obviously one of them was subjected to a huge internet storm, and the other one was increasingly intoxicated on the episodes, as far as I can tell, and was removed from the cast for just, you know, just being a bit of a problem. And you know, unfortunately, that does happen in games. But yeah, so yeah, I think,
So,
yeah, go
no, I was going to say, because
on.
we've sort of touched on the idea of what a GM or a DM does in terms of sort of facilitating, but also to an extent controlling play in as much as making sure it turns around and making sure that you know everyone has an element of the narrative to explore. It's quite a skilled job. Having seen, we'll refer back to Ben, Esther's PhD student and colleague, our colleague as well. My goodness, the time that Ben puts into sort of crafting these things, it's mad in terms of just the effort to make sure that there's a space for everyone who's playing and sort of a narrative that they can explore. But that brings me to one of the reasons we decided to do this podcast today. And I'm going to put this out now. I really hope you come back, Esther, because there's loads of other stuff to talk about beyond D&D, but we've kind of been a bit D&D centric today because I'm pretty sure the new Dungeon Master's Guide
It is the player's
is
handbook. Actually, no, it's the
Player's
Dungeon Master's Guide, isn't it? That's
Handbook.
why we, yes, the player's handbook's already out, but the DM's
Player's
guide
Handbook.
coming out soon. So yeah.
So what is a player's handbook? What's that for?
Okay, right. So most role-playing games have basically rule books. And the Dungeons and Dragons one is split into three: the player's handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual. Okay. Now, they've just been re-released in a new edition, sort of. Dungeons and Dragons tends to try and reinvent its rules about every 10 years. That's an approximation, but the 50-year anniversary means another lot of revised rules have come out. The original 5e, so fifth edition, is 992 pages long. So
This
that's
is
the
why I
manuals.
don't.
So that also gives you an idea of you don't need to know all those things. And in fact, it's the biggest barrier to entry because it, for a lot of people, they're just like, how on earth am I going to play this
I mean,
very,
you just saying 900 and something pages,
very. It's just
and that
ridiculous.
just genuinely puts the fear of something into me, and like, I will never be able to go and play. Like, no.
And the perception is also that you have to know absolutely everything back to front. You have to know how many, you have to know how many eyes a beholder has. You have to know, what kind of fire, what kind of breath a green dragon has, so on and so on and so on. All these details. In recent years, Wizards of the Coast, who are the people who publish Dungeons and Dragons, and in fact the people who play Dungeons and Dragons in things like actual plays like Critical Role, have been very keen on not only creating spaces where people can learn the rules, but also providing people who can do it for you.
That's what
Like,
I need, yeah.
and but also saying it doesn't matter if you don't get everything right. And my kind of take on this is you can't play a 992 page book correctly. You can't, it's impossible.
Well, yeah, it just sounds so much. It sounds so scary. It sounds, and if you look at it from the outside, and you're, I know she. So we're recording in our respective homes today. Has some problems with getting in the studio, which means my cat is making lots of guest appearances for us to kind of have a look at. But
It's
just
like
in
you've got
terms
the
of
chilled
that,
out one that's asleep at the back, and then you've
yes.
got like Chaos
I've
Kitty
got
at
the very,
the
very needy cat
front.
that kind of keeps making appearances. With the idea of the stereotype of the, and I think you used the word, so I'm going to use the word that, like the D&D nerd who would know all of the rules, and it kind of it feels too much somehow. So if they are trying to make it just more accessible and just more, I mean, player friendly, would that be a fair sort of assumption to make?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, one of the reasons that people have really loved actual plays and Critical Role is that they are really good at explaining the rules as they go along. And they're also, the players are very good at asking questions. The first, even in as the series progress and they start to get more effective at doing things, they explain things all the time. And the other thing that they do is they get things wrong. They make up their own rules. And they do things that there's a sort of unofficial rule called the rule of cool, which is if somebody does something, if a player does something and it seems really, really cool, work out a way of doing it. And the thing is, it's a game of improvisation. So if you are running a game of improvisation, you have to improvise back if people do things. And you also, I mean, for me as a dungeon master, your object is to make sure that people have a good time, but also allow them to have fun. And so that means if they do something really smart, you need to just think your way around it, and that's actually very good fun. But it also means that I'm not going to be looking up page 65 to work out whether or not they actually got that ability check correctly. I'm going to tell them to roll a dice, and they'll, if they get a six, they failed, and if they succeeded, they probably, you know, like a lot of it is not necessarily in people's heads, but it's kind of guessed based on guesses. If you look at the first set of rules from the first manual ever written, doesn't tell you what dice to roll.
Really?
No, Gygax and Anderson's original, who are the original authors,
Yeah.
it actually says something like, again, I don't have it to hand. It says something like, the dungeon master will tell you what to do. And
Okay.
the reason that it's written like that, the rules are terrible. The rules for the first version are absolutely terrible because it was designed to have those people in the room telling you what to do at the right at the same time.
Yes. Yeah.
They were like, oh, we can make a bit of money by selling these. But
Yeah.
actually, what they were doing was they were taking them along to games conventions,
Okay.
getting out their pens and paper and dice and maps, and saying, come along and play. Don't worry, we'll tell you how to do it. So it's
Right.
really interesting that it's gone through, you know, that's what it was at the very, very beginning. This game that was designed to be literally explained by mouth to people into
Yes.
these gigantic manuals that are just, you know, rules, 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 squares, you know, tessellation, da, 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 you've got to have your Thaco, you've
Yeah.
got to do this, you've got to have all your slogans and your bits and pieces, and you can't do it unless you've got this, and it, you know, you need to have 10 foot of rope and blah, 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 blah. But actually, it's moving back towards that. Go with it and then
Yeah.
work out how to do it, you know. And I think one of the things that Ben as a GM is very good at, he's really good. He's really good at responding to what people are doing as well. You know, he's a fantastic listener, and so he'll be listening to what everybody's doing, and he'll think, okay, well, I know how the game is going to work because he'll have spent all that time preparing it, and he does spend a long time preparing his games. But he'll also be able to think, well, hang on a minute, what does happen if they climb through the ceiling? What am I going to do?
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
I mean, I think most dungeon masters are flying by the seat of their pants most of the time, and most of them really like that. That, you know, that's the thing that they're like, I know it's going to get there in the end,
Yeah.
but you know,
How we get there
how we get there is yeah,
is open to those other people around the table, I presume.
absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a great example of this from Critical Role. I'm not going to go into huge amounts of detail about it. Again, I'm not going to spoiler it. But there is an encounter that is supposed to happen that's obviously meant to be a really, really big fight. And this is in the second season.
I was
One
going to
of
say, is
the
this in season two? Because I feel like I remember this, and there
this
was a
season
sort of a.
two. Yeah, this is one of my favorite, this is one of my absolute favorite role-playing moments ever, actually. And that includes the raging flaming poisoning sword of doom from the Adventure Zone, which I also think is a really wonderful a player using character dynamic in a really clever way. Anyway, it's going to be this big fight, and they've been building up to this fight for quite a lot of episodes. One of the characters has a curse on them, and they want to get the curse lifted. And so they go to the person who has put the curse on this character, and they have this incredibly creepy encounter. This character is in a hut. Now, this incredibly creepy encounter. And they keep going in, and the stakes are getting higher and higher as they kind of go in and out. And it's really obvious that the only way that they can deal with it is combat. Like, they're going to have to fight this awful thing, and it's probably going to really, really hurt them. It's in its lair. And one of the characters, she goes in, she uses an item that she has had in her bag for about 50 episodes. She gets a very, very lucky roll. But she knows that she needs the role, so she says to Matt Mercer, like, this does this. And then she casts a spell, and it solves the entire thing. She walks back out again. She says, don't worry, it's all sorted, but we probably need to leave now. And Matt Mercer has said he had a kind of 3 or 4 episode plot arc based on the fact that they were going to have a fight, and actually it's just gone. You know, it's just that kind of, you rip the paper up, the characters, you know, it's completely, oh well, I guess that's not going to happen.
But it's also the thing of this thing that's been carried, that has been found and is now carried in this bag for 50 odd episodes.
And
Suddenly,
it's also a
I
really good example of a player being really creative with something that seems completely useless.
Yeah.
Which I Absolutely is, you know, again, that kind of moment of player ingenuity. I just think it's absolutely wonderful where one of your players does something and you're just like, I would have never ever have thought of that. And it's so stupid. Yeah, it's stupid and it's funny and it's wonderful. And, you know, again, because what could have happened in that scenario is Matt Mercer could have said, oh, it just doesn't work. And I
Yes,
think that's one of the things that is, there's a lot of trust in role-playing games, because as a GM, I roll dice, the players roll dice. You can't always see what, I mean, I know some people will have all the dice out so you can kind of see what's happening. And we'll sort of say, you know, this is a skill check of whatever, whatever, whatever. But I tend to not do that because I like the flow of the play to go on. So I'll say, okay, roll to see if you succeed. And they'll roll. And as I say, if they roll a six, they've probably not done very well. And if they roll an 18, they've probably done okay. You know, and there's that sort of middle zone of they're going to trust me to make a fair decision. But also, you know, in that situation, you see Matt rolling and she says, does the player says, do I succeed? Or she might say, does she fail? I can't remember which one it is. And he says, yes, you do. Or no, she doesn't
Yes,
succeed.
the good one, yeah.
But he doesn't say, oh yes, a three, a four, and a three, a four, and a two, you know.
No, but I like you say, I think that's part of. So I think that's probably part of having Matt Mercer running the game, in as much as they all know each other, but also he's an incredibly experienced GM. So whichever way that would go, he will cope
Yes,
with that. Perhaps someone much less experienced might not always might fluff it a little bit, just because they've maybe planned this
No,
out for a really
absolutely.
long time. And I guess also, if you think of sometimes like group dynamics, maybe a big part of it is the combat, or is the sort
That's
of that
absolutely,
very
you know,
active part of D&D.
And there's an element of grace there as well, because there's the sort of grace that he had to accept the fact that his whole thing was just, you know,
Everything
gone.
just
But
screw it up, put it in the bin.
also the rest of the party, the rest of the people around that table were also gearing up for a really big fight, you know. So there's, again, in when you're sort of talking about social dynamics, there's that kind of having the good grace to back down is, you know, and not being like, oh well, I've just wasted six of my spells preparing to do this, you know, because maybe you did, and that's, you know, them's the breaks. But that is a very, that is, you know, again, there's a lot of writing about GMs like Matt Mercer, Brennan Lee Mulligan, Bria, and you know, Jasmine, and all of the other sort of really wonderful GMs out there at the moment, just about sort of when you start to play, don't compare yourself to them, because they are at the top. I mean, again, it's like a fantastic comparison. I actually saw somebody saying it's like watching athletes, you know, they're kind
Because
of at the
that
Olympic.
level, the fact that, I mean, you can tell that the players aren't always super knowledgeable about some of the approaches or modifiers and things, and he just rolls out the, even just that, like rolling out the modifiers and kind of clarifying what you need to roll for, and that just those, like, but what I would assume are quite basic things, but just
But
rolling
not
them out,
necessarily as
you
well, because
know?
there's so much detail that, again, I don't, I, you know, I actually use, I use a lot of online resources, and in fact they do now as well. They use D&D Beyond, I think, still, as
Well, no, they
I'm
do.
quite
Yeah,
behind on
that rings
season.
the bell. Yeah.
But actually having things that do it for you are incredibly useful. I played a tabletop role-playing strategy board game for a long time called Gloomhaven, and I wouldn't have been able to play it without the app. I just wouldn't have been able to. It's just so, there's just too much to remember. And I think, again, that's, you know, we don't need to be purists about play, I think. Anyway, we need to roll up because I have to go on to my next meeting, which isn't a
We
podcast.
do. Oh, it's not going to be as
I
interesting as
have been
this
in
one.
podcasts all morning, so
Esther, thank you. so much for coming on. I really hope we can do this again and talk a little bit more about representation in game and just expand into some of those areas. Thank you so much. That's another
Thank you.
episode of Game Changers. Hope you come back, Esther, and thank you so much. Yay!
Yeah, thank you. Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.